UN peacekeepers and human rights workers are in the news all the time, but how much do we really know about the day-to-day, on-the-ground work they do? It's dangerous, stressful, hopefully life-saving, but it also carries enormous personal costs. Marianne Elliott is a human rights lawyer who thought she'd seen it all working in the Gaza Strip. Then she joined the UN Human Rights Office in Afghanistan, which is, of course, one of the most unstable, violent regions in the world. She is a courageous woman. She's committed to doing good in the world, and she shares some of the lessons she learned in a memoir called Zen Under Fire. Marianne, welcome. I'm so glad you could join us today.
Thank you so much, Anne. Thank you for having me.
Yeah. Your memoir is a deep meditation on what it means to be a peacekeeper, not just professionally, but also personally. How are those two kinds of peacekeeping related?
I suppose in many ways that's what I was learning in Afghanistan. What I was discovering was that what was going on inside me, the way that I was emotionally, psychologically responding to my work, was inevitably having an effect on my ability to do my work professionally. And so to the extent that I was able, or initially unable, to find healthy ways to process what I was experiencing, I was becoming less and less effective in my work.
Mm. Now, you went to Afghanistan to take what was a dream job for you, working with the UN there. Why was this a dream job?
Well, I suppose I use that word in the sense that when I was a child, when I was a teenager, as I began to understand what the United Nations did in the simple way that a teenager understood it, that was what I wanted to be part of in the world. I had a little bit of exposure as a very young child to wildly different environments. We lived in Papua New Guinea when I was a small child, returning to New Zealand and seeing the contrast in terms of economic opportunity, in terms of access to justice. And even as a small child, had the sense that things were not the same around the world and wanted to be part somehow of the effort that was being made, that I understood as I grew older was being made to address those injustices and inequalities. And the UN really in many ways represented the epitome of that. So it was a job I'd wanted to have for a long time. And I was already in Afghanistan working with a non-governmental group, or actually a number of non-governmental organisations, not-for-profits, doing human rights research. And it was when that contract ended that I was offered the role with the UN.
Mm-hmm. And what was the job, or what did you expect to be doing?
It was the job that I accepted was as a human rights officer with the peacekeeping mission, the United Nations assistance mission to Afghanistan. So that's with the Department of Peacekeeping Operations. And human rights officers in those missions are responsible for monitoring, so keeping an eye on, obviously, human rights, whether that's within the penal system, the justice system, broadly any kind of issues related to women's rights. And also we were responsible as human rights officers in Afghanistan for monitoring the actions of the international military forces and keeping an eye and documenting the extent to which international military forces were respecting international humanitarian law or the law of war.
So is this the kind of job where you expected you would be on the ground, out on the streets a lot, investigating, I mean, visiting people in their homes, visiting military camps, talking with local police?
Yes, and actually that's why I took it. The job that I had with the not-for-profit in Kabul was a research-based job, but my job was really sitting in an office in Kabul helping design the research projects, helping manage the research projects, and doing what is actually very important work, which is the work of taking the results of that research and using it to advocate with both Afghan policymakers and decision makers within the international donor community. But what I was looking for, what I wanted, was an opportunity to get out into the field in Afghanistan, as you say, to get into prisons, into police stations, to work more directly and to have a chance to really meet both community members of the part of Afghanistan I was going to work in, and also to meet people within those communities who were already champions for human rights, mm-hmm. So people who were already leading the the efforts for human rights in those communities.
So those were your expectations, but when you took the job, you'd been there for about a month or something, and then there's this moment of rude awakening when your boss basically was burned out, went on vacation, left you in charge, and then this unexpected crisis blew up. What happened?
Well, so to the office had been understaffed for some time, which is not uncommon, obviously, in places like Afghanistan, although it's an appealing area to work in. Many people want to work in humanitarian work. It's hard to find people who have the qualification and experience. So he'd been holding the fort along with a couple of other senior staff members. And so when I got there, and although I was very new to that role, I did have quite a lot of experience in Afghanistan and, well, I don't think it's a small amount of experience in Afghanistan.
Well, you'd worked you'd worked in the Gaza Strip too.
I'd worked in the Gaza Strip.
Right.
I wasn't, you know, they expected me to be able to kind of handle myself.
You'd been in war zones before.
I had. So he left, and I took over his job, which was not a human rights position. So I was really just holding the fort in what was a more political role, the responsibility of that role really was to represent the UN peacekeeping mission in the region and to use the what they call the good offices of the UN, you know, the kind of the reputation, the influence of the UN to try and resolve conflicts peacefully.
Mm-hmm.
I did have some doubts about my ability to do that because it relies so much on relationships, on people trusting you and respecting you, and they didn't even know me. But it was going to be over the Eid period, which is a holiday at the end of Ramadan. So it's a little bit like you're watching the office, but you're watching it over the Christmas break, you know. So nothing's really supposed to happen over the Christmas break. And he kind of said, you'll be fine, you know, as long as nobody kills Amanullah Khan, who was a big warlord in the area, you'll be fine. And I presume that that's kind of, you know, not going to happen, obviously. He leaves at 9 a.m. and by midday that day, Amanullah Khan had been assassinated. Yeah.
Oh.
And I when I read from the book now to people and I read that section, they, of course, can all see it coming. It seems like it's the obvious outcome, but it didn't obviously seem that way to me at the time, or I wouldn't have agreed to hold the fort. But what happened was that Amanullah Khan's supporters, the people from his tribe, believed that they knew who was responsible for his assassination and went out on retributive missions and basically went into villages of the tribe that they believed was responsible. And what I was receiving sitting in my office in Herat were these reports of high numbers of fatalities as these soldiers, really, from Amanullah Khan's tribe were moving through the villages and taking retribution for his killing. And this is exactly the sort of conflict that my office is supposed to try and find a peaceful resolution to. So it was very, very much the worst case scenario for me for the first day that I could be left in charge of that office.
I imagine you did everything you could. Were you able to be effective?
You know, I can look back now, Anne, and see that with the experience I had, the information I had, I did as well as I possibly could under the circumstances. And with a little bit more perspective, I can see that even somebody with more experience may not have been able to do anything more effective because of the way that the situation was unfolding. But at the time, I believed that my lack of experience could have played a hand in my inability to resolve, or to help, not to resolve, but to play a part in bringing about a peaceful resolution fast enough to save more lives. And so what happened was I came out of that period, by the time my boss came back, took over again, and I could kind of have some space to breathe, I came out with this very heavy burden, sense of personal responsibility for those deaths, including the deaths of more than 20 children, and a sense of very deep guilt. And as I say, with distance now, I see that the guilt was really irrational. But I think that that's not uncommon when you're in that kind of situation where, in theory, you have the ability to save lives, and in practice, it probably was never going to be possible.
I remember reading it in your book, you begged to be allowed to go to see the women and children. They had fled to some neighboring villages, and there were reports that they were there. You didn't know what kind of condition they'd be in. You weren't at first allowed to go there, I guess, because it was considered just too dangerous?
It was. And there was an element in the assassination of Amanullah Khan where there were rumors flying, and this is not uncommon in conflict situations, that there are all sorts of rumors about who was behind it. There were some rumors that American military forces may have been behind the assassination of Amanullah Khan, which meant that sort of anti-American and therefore sort of generally anti-foreigner feelings were very high in the area, and that was partly why the Afghan security officials were particularly concerned about the idea of me, obviously Western-looking, hopping into a white UN 4x4 and driving right into the middle of it. So they were right, and I think it could have had the potential to not only to put me in danger, to put my Afghan colleagues in danger, but maybe to inflame the situation. So I had to wait.
Yeah, which must have been incredibly stressful. I mean, you must have been waiting there and the whole time thinking about women and children, imagining, I don't know, what were you imagining?
Well, I really didn't know what condition the people who had fled the fighting were in. It was very difficult to get reports, but there certainly were, as I say, again, you're often dealing with rumour in this kind of situation, but there were rumours, and I had reason to think they might be founded, that there were women and children who had fled the fighting into areas where they had nowhere to stay, no food really to eat, no clothing to wear. They'd left in the night with nothing, and obviously not having been able to prevent the deaths initially, I felt very strongly that I wanted to do whatever I could to improve the condition of those who had survived. And there were things that I could do without going there. I think in the book I write about how UN agencies respond in a situation like that, how we, you know, the different agencies in Herat were able to come together and get information, albeit secondhand, from people in the area about the needs that might exist and be able to actually get some basic resources in to the area, just not using any foreigners.
Well, so here's the issue. You've just described a perfect storm of stress and guilt and anxiety. And for an aid worker, this is par for the course. So the question is, you know, how do you personally handle this? I mean, do you just develop a really tough skin?
That is one way that people handle it. And one of the things that I chose to do when I wrote this book was I chose to write about the effect that this kind of work had on me personally. And in some ways that was an unusual choice to make, because in this area of work, in the human rights, humanitarian response work, there is a reluctance really to talk about, there has been traditionally a reluctance to talk about the personal impact that this work can take on people. And I was talking about this book yesterday actually in Boston, and there was a woman there who has worked on women's rights in conflict for many years. And what she said she found surprising about my book in a good way was that it went against what she believed were two of the great taboos of our sector, which were firstly, we don't have feelings, or if we have them, we don't talk about them. And secondly, we don't put ourselves in the story. And I did both of those things in this book because, firstly, we do have feelings. I can't imagine how you could do this work and not have feelings. So if we have them, it seemed to me that at some point it made sense to talk about them. And I did put myself in the story, because once you're there, you become part of the story, whether or not that's in a positive way, a way that is helping or not, but you're part of the story. And so when this happened to me in Afghanistan, I think what it revealed was that I didn't have the tools that I needed to deal with the feelings that that kind of work was, you know, that the work was bringing up for me. I didn't know what to do with the guilt, with the grief, with the anxiety. And that's really what I explored, one of the things that I explored in the book.
When we come back, we'll hear how you developed those tools and what you discovered. Marianne Elliott is an attorney and human rights advocate. She served as a United Nations peacekeeper in Afghanistan. She's the author of Zen Under Fire. And I wonder, are there any peacekeepers out there? If you have served as a peacekeeper or worked in conflict zones, how would you describe how you handled the stress and the challenges? You can join the conversation by calling 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or you can send us a Facebook message. It's 45 North on WPR. Later this hour, Khaled Husseini, the author of The Kite Runner, will join us. He has a brand new novel out, also set in his native Afghanistan. It's called And the Mountains Echoed. I'm Anne Strange-Hamps, and you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Anne Strange-Hamps, and hey, there's something special happening later today on Wisconsin Public Radio. The first pilot for a brand new show is airing this afternoon. It's called Central Time, hosted by my friends and colleagues Veronica Rickert and Rob Ferret. The show covers a range of topics, both cultural and newsworthy, and we are inviting you to check it out and provide some feedback. It airs from 3 to 6 this afternoon right here on this station, so check it out. Right now we're talking with Marianne Elliott about her time serving as a UN peacekeeper and human rights advocate in Afghanistan. And Marianne, the subtitle of your memoir is How I Found Peace in the Midst of War. You're a yoga practitioner and a yoga teacher, and I know this is a practice you turned to a great deal when you were in Afghanistan. How has yoga philosophy affected your view of working in war zones?
I think what yoga was teaching me when I was in Afghanistan was that it's possible to be in a deeply uncomfortable place without either resisting that, you know, avoiding it, refusing to feel the discomfort, but also without being drowned in it, without losing yourself, being completely overwhelmed by it. And the way I think of it is when I get on my yoga mat and do, whether it's a seated meditation or a pose, you know, the physical practice, I'm practicing. I'm literally practicing the skills that I need for the rest of my life. I'm practicing putting myself into situations where, let's say it's a seated meditation, all kinds of thoughts and feelings and ideas and sensations are going to come, and some will be unpleasant, some will be unwelcome, but I can stay. I don't have to run away. I don't have to get up and distract myself. And eventually those feelings will change. And I think that's what I needed to learn in Afghanistan, was my default had been this terrible sense of guilt is so hard to deal with that I have to somehow make it go away. And I was trying everything that I knew to make it go away, and it wasn't working. And eventually I kind of gave up and decided, well, maybe I'll finally just sit on my, you know, this cushion in my room every morning. Everybody tells me meditation will help. I don't understand how, but at this point it can't hurt. And I slowly, little by little, discovered that if I let myself actually just feel the emotions, not try to make a big story about them, not grab onto them, fix them, change them, that in their own time they would change. And I think that became, for me at least, the tool that I needed to be able to do the work that I was doing.
Sounds like a completely different approach to how probably most people in your position deal with the kinds of situations which you were in, which is to try to, well, I'm thinking about the yoga term soft belly. Most people try to develop a hard belly, that thick skin, you know, to resist the guilt and even the anger that might come up, rather than just letting them sort of wash through you. Did you find that the results were different when you were able to soften and not resist?
Yeah, certainly the results were different for me. I had a different experience. But I also, I think, and you know, this was the feedback I got, particularly as the book goes on, I move to a very remote part of Afghanistan, a province called Khor province, to a town called Chakchiran, very small town. I was at, the only substantive UN, international UN staff member in that province, so was fairly isolated. And I was practicing the meditation, practicing the yoga and applying that where I could in my work. So when I was sitting with somebody who was telling me, you know, a very traumatic or a very disturbing story about what had happened to them, I would practice the same basic principle of, rather than when my feelings came up in response to what they were telling me, rather than trying to put distance between myself and my feelings so that I wasn't feeling anything about their story, I was practicing, so what about if I let myself feel that, but I also let it keep moving so it doesn't get stuck with me? And the people who I was working with, the Afghan people in that community, they did say things to me along the lines of, it feels to me like you really are really listening. It feels to me like you really care about what I'm telling you, and I'm not used to that. Which is certainly not to say that nobody else doing this work has that kind of empathetic presence. I know a lot of people who do, but not everybody does. And as you say, for some people, the solution is to get a thicker skin, detach themselves further from the people they're working with. And I guess my question is, where does that get you in the end? If you, if that kind of ability to detach ourselves from others and not let ourselves feel what they might be suffering is part of the problem that leads to this sort of conflict, do we want it to be the heart of our coping mechanism for how we respond?
Well, I guess the philosophy behind what you're saying is, and certainly this would apply to many situations besides war zones. That's an extreme example, but really anybody in a caring profession, for instance, I can imagine, or any kind of stressful situation this would apply to. The idea is that if you're not kind of whole yourself, there, it's going to limit what you can do to help other people. Is that
absolutely? Yeah.
So
absolutely.
I'm curious about what it came to mean for you to be, I don't know, to be a Zen peacekeeper.
Well, you know, I use the word Zen in a general sense. So, as I say in the introduction to my book, you know, there is a specific meaning of the word Zen, which is a very specific Japanese Buddhist tradition, and it's a tradition that I have a lot of respect for and that I have done some practice in, because I have a teacher, a writing and meditation teacher, Natalie Goldberg, who is a wonderful writing teacher and a Zen teacher, and I've studied with her and practiced Zen meditation practice with her. But in the book title and in the way that I use the word in relation to my story, I'm using the word Zen in its broader sense, which is in fact a Japanese translation of a Chinese word which comes from Sanskrit for meditation. Mm. So it's the practice for me of meditation. I'm using it in that broad sense.
Mm. I was wondering if there were, I mean, sort of thinking philosophically about aid work or about the effort to do good in the world, that's a complicated thing. And it seems to me that maybe there's a philosophy that might flow out of, you know, you're discovering that what you were trying to do was keep yourself whole, to stay present. I'm wondering if there's a different kind of philosophy for how to do good that grew out of that.
Very much so. And the other thing that grew out of that, so I couldn't agree with you more that the effort to do good or the impulse to do good, I think, is very simple, very universal. But the reality of doing good, particularly when you step out of the cultural environment in which you are most familiar, is very complicated. And our desires to do good are often complicated. Our motivations to do good, certainly mine, and I spend some time examining them in my book, because I think one of the things that came up for me was, what if the work I'm doing isn't having as much positive impact as I thought it was? What does that mean for who I am, for what my place in the world is, what my worth in the world is? And what I started to realize was my desire to do good, my motivation to be in that work, was partly, not completely, but certainly partly, it's about me and my identity and how I feel about myself. And I came to the view that it was important to be aware of that. And that is part of, I suppose, the Zen tradition. It's certainly part of how I use the word Zen, which is, you know, the practice of meditation and also the practice of seeing things clearly, being willing to see yourself, your actions, and the impact that your actions are having clearly, which sometimes means seeing that things are not as you want them to be.
It sounds like you're talking about shifting from a perspective in which what you're trying to do is change the world, to, which is a very active kind of perspective, to a perspective in which you're trying to be of service. I mean, it's maybe a subtle difference, but I think there's a difference.
I agree. And I began to use the language of being of service more and more as I got towards the end of my time in Afghanistan, and certainly the way I would describe my life now. So I agree with you about the difference. And it's, in itself, there's a complexity in here. I have... I'm going in August to a Buddhist conference where I've been asked to talk about the limits of practice, which is, okay, we know that there's a very essential part of transformative work, which is about our own wholeness, our own willingness to practice seeing ourselves clearly. But what are the limits of that? What does social change, positive social change, require? And can that kind of personal inner work get us all the way? And my answer would be, well, no, it's essential, it's foundational, but we also have to understand what are the structures, the social structures that are sustaining certain kinds of social inequality, certain kinds of injustice, certain kinds of oppression. And so there's that as well. So, you know, I also continue to be interested in and involved in the sort of social change work which is more externally focused, more action focused. But I want that to always be grounded in the kind of clarity that comes from my own practice.
So when you're can you take these lessons that you learned through working in war zones and apply them to other situations, other people's lives? I mean, you know, we don't all work in war zones, but is there something you learned that you think would be valuable to the rest of us, you know, whether we're in a workplace, in business, in a family life?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, this is still very much part of my daily life, and I'm no longer in a war zone. As you said, it really applies to anybody who is engaged in caring for others, and that's most of us. Whether it's in a professional capacity, as you say, you know, then people maybe not working internationally, but domestically, there are so many people who work in various ways and who either care for or have responsibility for. So whether you're a nurse or a social worker or a policeman or a you know, working in the penal system, there are so many roles where you are encountering other people's suffering in many different ways, and where that's likely to be having an impact on you. It's inevitably going to be having an impact on you. But not only professionally, I mean, in my personal life, I know, you know, I have friends right now who are young and have cancer. I have friends who have lost a daughter. I have people in my life who are suffering, and in order to be of service to them, I need to be aware of the impact that being in contact with their suffering has on me, and I need to have tools for processing that so that when I show up to be of service to them, I'm not coming with a whole lot of unprocessed stuff of my own. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah, it does. Is there one last, just quickly, one last thing, a thought you would want to leave us with returning to Afghanistan? Something you brought home with you that you would want other people to know about Afghanistan?
There is. And interestingly, I actually read Khalid Hosseini being asked the same question recently, and he has a very similar answer to mine, which is that I really want people to know that change is happening in Afghanistan. I was back there last year and I visited a lot of friends, and they wanted me to know and they wanted me to share that a lot of changes have happened in the past decade. You know, women are back in the workplace, girls are at school, telecommunications has opened the world to young Afghan people. The internet means that people can experience and connect with the world, and that these changes are really very significant in terms of human rights, in terms of just people's day-to-day lives. And Afghans are concerned about how they're going to be able to preserve those changes when the international forces withdraw. And they believe, and I'm sure they're right, that the key to preserving those will be that they're not forgotten, that the world doesn't forget Afghanistan once our soldiers, our international forces, are not present there. And I guess that's something that I carry with me as I take this book out into the world, that I hope it will keep Afghanistan in the minds and the hearts of people all around the world.
Marianne, thank you for talking today, and thank you for your work.
Thank you, Anne. Thank you for having me.
Marianne Elliott is the author of Zen Under Fire: How I Found Peace in the Midst of War. She's a human rights lawyer and advocate, and she's worked in Afghanistan, the Gaza Strip, many other places. I'm Anne Strange Jampson. This is 45 North on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You probably remember Khalid Hosseini as the author of The Kite Runner, the best-selling novel that was later made into a film. His family left Afghanistan when he was 11, and he's lived in the U.S. most of his life, but his homeland is at the center of all of his books. He's just published his first new novel in 6 years. It's called And the Mountains Echoed. It's set in Afghanistan and is the story of a brother and a sister who were separated as children. Khalid, this book opens with a story, a folktale, which not only sets the stage for the rest of the book, but kind of echoes through it in different ways. I was wondering, could you begin by telling us that story?
Sure. The fable is actually being told by a father to his two children the night before they're going to set off from this village and go to Kabul. But the fable is about a village that is visited by a creature called a div, which is this mythical creature that has been prevalent in Persian literature and mythology for a long, long time. And the div comes to this village and picks a household and demands that that household grant him one child that he will then take away, and the family will never see the child again. If the family refuses, then the div will take all the children from the household. So he picks the household of this old peasant who's got five kids. They draw straws, and he has to give away his favorite child to this creature.
It's heartbreaking to read and also really beautiful. What was in your mind when you wrote it?
Well, I used the fable as a kind of a peek into the mind of a man, a father who's telling this story to his children and is about to make a rather agonizing decision of his own. And it's his way of explaining, I think, his actions to his kids, particularly his boy.
Yeah. Well, at the heart of this story are these two children, Abdullah and this little boy and his sister, Pari. And we meet them that night when their father is telling them that fable. And the next day, they are separated for close to the rest of their lives. What happens?
Well, you know, we meet them you know, as they're crossing a desert with their father, and they're walking to Kabul, where their father has ostensibly found work for, you know, construction work, where he's going to build something for this wealthy couple. What happens there is you know, I don't want to give away too much, but it basically ruptures the bond between the boy and his sister. And that's the heart of the book, is this very loving relationship between Abdullah, who's 10 years old, and his little sister, Pari. And they're extremely close. He's almost like both father and mother to his little sister. They've lost their mother in childbirth when Pari was born, and they're not particularly close to their stepmother. And so the loss of his little sister is very wounding to Abdullah, and in many ways shapes the adult that he eventually becomes, whom we'll meet later in the book. And it also affects Pari in more subtle but no less profound ways, and also shapes the person that she becomes. And sort of the respective absences of these two people from each other's lives becomes a kind of looms over the rest of the novel.
Yeah, kind of like the primal wound. But it's fascinating to me. I mean, you've written about so many different family relationships in your books, and in this time in particular, you're really exploring the relationship between siblings. Do you have siblings yourself?
Yeah, I'm the oldest of five. So I have three brothers and I have a sister. I don't know that I really particularly have drawn from my own relationship with my siblings, but it is a relationship that interests me tremendously.
And why does that interest you? What is it about siblings and the sibling relationship that interests you?
Oh, I think it's just so rich. It's so full of contradictory dynamics. You know, it's an intense relationship. You share genes. You share, you know, these very powerful, transformative events in childhood. We all do. You know, it's defined by love and affection, and yet it's riddled with envy and with jealousy and pettiness and contempt and competition, while still rooted in, you know, and love.
Well, it's impossible, at least for me, to read this and not think about siblings in other larger ways also. I mean, surely this could also be the story of Afghanistan itself, a story of a country whose people, whose brothers and sisters have been, many of them, separated from each other through war. Is there a way in which you also can see the sibling theme playing out in terms of your own country?
You know, the theme of separation is pervasive in the book, in that there is a kind of absence in the lives of the characters in this book. And it's really a book about how we as people are bound by our sense of loss. I mean, we all are defined by things that we've lost, you know, whether it is a family member, whether it is pride or dignity or beauty or memory or wealth or possession or ambition or hope or things that feel vital to us that have left these gaping holes in our lives that we try to fill in different ways, and things that we either realistically or metaphorically try to reunite with.
Well, and I guess, like your characters, so many of them have a choice about how they're going to deal with something that they've been separated from that they loved. Are they going to cling to those memories, mm-hmm. and keep those memories alive, or are they going to forget and move mm-hmm. on and create a new life? And I suppose, you know, you've kind of had those choices also. You know, I think anybody who has lost a homeland has that choice. Do you completely embrace the new world, or do you do whatever you can to hold on to the old?
Well, and what I've ended up doing is a little bit of both. I mean, I can't extricate Afghanistan from myself. I mean, there's a deep core within me that is emotionally bound to the place where I was born, to the you know, where I was raised, where I learned to talk, and I had so many of my, you know, fundamental early life experiences, people that I loved, and it's just that will always be with me. And at the same time, you know, I've now lived in the United States for 32 years. I have deep roots in this country. I have dear friends. I'm part of a community. You know, I've fathered children in this country, and you know, I've made my life here. So I feel bound to both, and I, at least for myself, speaking for myself, I don't feel like I have to make that choice. You know, I've sort of have a foot in each world.
To return to that theme of forgetting and remembering,
mm-hmm.
the little girl, Pari, who winds up moving away to Paris, she's so young when mm-hmm. she's taken from Afghanistan, she really barely remembers. But you write, there's some really beautiful passages where you write about that she has this kind of sense that something's missing. I wrote this down. What did she? Oh, yeah. She felt this absence. You wrote, it was vague, like a message sent across shadowy byways and vast distances, a weak signal on a radio dial, remote, warbled. Other times it felt so clear, this absence, so intimately close, it made her heart lurch. Sounds like you know that feeling.
I don't know that that's personal experience, mm-hmm. but what I loved about Pari, who's the little girl who separated from her brother and ends up moving to Europe and doesn't really even really remember her brother, doesn't even really remember her former life because it all happened when she was so young. And yet there's this sense that there's a hole in her life, that there is, that the narrative of her life is incomplete. She just has a sense that there's a blind spots that her adoptive mother has not filled in for her. And, you know, she says in that chapter that, you know, a parent's job is to kind of take these scraps of memories that are otherwise disjointed and glue them together and provide the glue so that you can fashion a cohesive and understandable narrative of your own life. And she feels like that's missing from her life. But I really kind of liked writing about this kind of vague but very much in this very powerful kind of aching that was always in her life.
It's funny that both the loss of her memory she feels as a kind of wound. And yet there are plenty of other characters in the book for whom memories are very painful.
Yes. This theme of memory opens the book and ends the book. You know, and I kind of really enjoyed exploring this idea of memory either as this thing that allows us to make sense of our life, as something, a faculty through which we make sense of who we are, of our world, that gives us our identity, something that protects those parts of our life that we cherish the most and experiences that are so meaningful to us, or as this kind of dictator that forces upon you things you would rather forget, experiences that are wounding and painful to live through, and yet we have to because we don't have a choice. And so this, you know, dual nature of memory begins the book. In the fable that I spoke about earlier, the father is given a potion by this creature through which he can forget about his son, and he can forget about the loss of his son, and that sort of pain is magically removed from his life.
Well, and that question of, is the potion a gift or a curse?
Right.
I mean, what about for you personally? Do you feel like your memories of Afghanistan are more blessing or curse?
To me, they're a blessing because they're very happy memories for the most part. I was fortunate enough to live through the final years of an era that is an almost forgotten bygone era now. I mean, to the average person, you say the word Afghanistan, and the set of images that it conjures is so different from my childhood memories, in which Afghanistan was, you know, let's not overplay it. You know, it was a deeply impoverished country then, and people lived in abject poverty even then. But nevertheless, you know, this were the days before extremism and before the Taliban, before the criminal networks and the terrorists and, all the foreign troops and so on. It was, comparatively speaking, a far more innocent era, certainly peaceful and from my perspective, a very happy era. And so I cherish those memories. I wouldn't trade them for anything. And they're memories that I've dipped into in my novels over and over again.
Well, I was thinking, I know President Karzai some years ago, actually it's back around 2002, I think, made a famous speech in which he called on the people who had left Afghanistan to return. And I was thinking, maybe what Afghanistan needs is not necessarily for all of its people to return, but for those who remember what Afghanistan was like when it was still whole, to keep those memories alive.
Yes, I think that does serve a purpose, but we have more or less passed the baton on now to the youth of Afghanistan. And I think the memories that will end up serving Afghanistan well is those of the youthful population of Afghanistan. It's a fundamentally young country. 60% is under the age of 20. And they've come of age during the war. And they, you know, and I think they will use those memories to shape a different future for Afghanistan. Not in the immediate future. I think the immediate future is quite worrisome and anxiety-provoking. But in the long term, I think the youth of Afghanistan that has a different agenda for the future and different vision for the future of its country, this is now a population that is becoming increasingly savvy. You know, the young, urban, professional Afghans, they're increasingly sophisticated in their thinking through their involvement with technology, through the internet, through the sort of interconnectedness of the modern world. It can't be stopped. You know, eventually new experiences, new ways of thinking will infiltrate Afghanistan. And I think that is the way of the future. In the immediate future may be cloudy, may be worrisome, and may be painful to watch. But I think ultimately Afghanistan will change from within because of its young population that does have these painful memories. And I think they're motivated to do something about them.
Khaled, is there a section from your book you might end by reading for us?
I'd love to. The section I'm about to read is we meet Pari, who is a little girl who was torn from her brother. She's now, I guess, in her 60s, and she's living in France, and she has received a phone call through which she learns about the fact that she had a brother. Pari's hands shake. A startling thing is happening to her, something truly remarkable. The picture of it in her mind is of an axe striking soil and suddenly rich black oil bubbling up to the surface. This is what's happening to her. Memory is struck upon, rising up from the depths. She gazes out the window in the direction of the brasserie, but what she sees is not the skinny waiter beneath the awning, black apron tied at the waist and shaking a cloth over a table, but a little red wagon with a squeaky wheel bouncing along beneath a sky of unfurling clouds, rolling over ridges and down dried-up gullies, up and down ochre hills that loom and then fall away. She sees washing lines and women squatting by a stream, and a hawk-nosed man digging a ditch, shirt plastered to his back with sweat, and a veiled woman bent over a cooking fire. But something else, too, at the edge of it all, at the rim of her vision, and this is what draws her most, an elusive shadow, a figure, at once soft and hard, the softness of a hand holding hers, the hardness of knees where she'd once rested her cheek. She searches for his face, but it evades her, slips from her each time she turns to it. Pari feels a hole opening up in her. There has been in her life, all her life, a great absence. Somehow she has always known. "Brother," she says, unaware she's speaking, unaware she's weeping.
That's beautiful. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
It was
my pleasure entirely.
Khaled Hosseini is the best-selling author of The Kite Runner and A Thousand Splendid Suns. His new novel is called And the Mountains Echoed. For more information, check our Facebook page. Don't forget to like us while you're there. It's 45 North on WPR. I'm Ann Strainchamps, and you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.